Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Many years into his career as a candle designer for Christian worship services, our guest today had his own spiritual awakening. Martin Markland realized he should honor the work of the bees, whose wax made his liturgical candles so successful, sought by churches and cathedrals around the world. So Markland became a beekeeper, and he says, "It transformed my life." Now, the candle production facility he and his wife run in Contoocook, New Hampshire, includes more than 100 beehives. And he says he's become an evangelist for honeybees, educating others about the vital importance of protecting them. Today in The Exchange, a Christmas story that starts in New Hampshire and extends far beyond. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Martin Markland, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure.
So we've talked a lot on this show, Martin, about the importance of bees for pollination and some about honey. But let's talk about how you got involved in the bees, Martin, through many years of making these huge liturgical beeswax candles. And listeners should go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange, and they can see them. What got you started, first of all, in making these big specialty candles for churches and cathedrals?
It's a long story, but the short answer is back in St. Louis, when I was a young boy, I was the server at our parish, and the large Easter candle we had at Holy Cross in St. Louis was made by a couple, and they were hand-carved this candle. And I remember distinctly as a young boy rubbing my finger across that design. Fast forward, I went to the seminary, came home one year, and we had this less-than-beautiful candle on the altar. And it had a Mylar decal stuck on it. So I said to Sister Mary Grace, "What happened?" And she says, "Well, Jarowskis are no longer making it." So I said, "Get me a candle, and I'll try my this craft." So I invented, resurrected, as it were, on my mom and dad's kitchen table in St. Louis, carving Paschal candles, which is the Easter candle.
Plastic decals versus a hand-carved candle. I can see the difference already.
Yeah, and then so we fast forward. A priest friend of mine said, "Hey, kid, you got something here. The church needs good candles. No one else is doing this." So he gave me a few dollars in 1985 to start my company. So out of my mom and dad's basement, I went door-to-door knocking on churches, and I sold 6 candles in my first year.
Wow.
Next year, 12 months later, I sold 18. I tripled my sales. And then it went to 35 to 75. And only after 5 years doing this, I was only up to 150 candles a year. Then things took off, and fortunately today I don't have to go door to door.
Well, and we'll talk about, you know, the bees and the beeswax and why that's important and so forth, and how that kind of, as I said, made you an evangelist for honeybees. But just for our listeners, just describe these candles that you make, Martin, because they're big and they're special, and they have been sold to, you know, not just churches but cathedrals around the world, including a few popes.
They are. There's 7 companies in the United States that do candles for churches, and we're one of 7. I like to tell people we're the youngest and smallest. But these are large candles. They can weigh up to 60 pounds. Our largest candle is 5 inches in diameter, 72 inches tall. And you need over 1.1 million bees to make that one candle. These are very large candles. We ship them all around the world, as far away as Guam. And these candles burn in churches as the primary source for the light of Christ. And it's a significant thing. They're oftentimes adorned, and the technique by which we decorate these candles is really what's made us distinctive. But these are, every candle is handmade, hand-decorated, and shipped throughout the world.
Well, and made out of beeswax. And let's talk about why that's important. Yeah, what's the difference?
There used to be a rule or the Catholic bishops in the United States had a regulation many years ago that candles used in worship had to be at least half beeswax. So we candle makers are good Catholics. We only do what's required. So we make them 51% beeswax. And in Canada, they had the rule that it had to be at least two-thirds, so they make them 67%.
Oh, wow, that's a lot of beeswax.
And the idea was really that the other alternative is paraffin, which is a petroleum product. And the thought was really that the bee and the wax from the bee was more appropriate for liturgical services. And the bee has long been a symbol of industriousness as well as a sign throughout the Bible. You know, thy words are as sweet as honey from the comb. And there's references to these bees. So the naturalness of the bees. And once you burn a beeswax candle, there's no comparison between that and a paraffin candle. Now, the church has relaxed that rule. The church is no longer need to buy beeswax, but we have this long tradition of buying beeswax candle and beeswax being the premier burning substance for candles that churches today buy are not inexpensive candles because of the quality of the wax.
So what's the difference between burning a regular candle and a candle made with 51% beeswax? Is it, you know, less smoky? Is it less drippy? Does it smell better?
Well, people want to think that beeswax is cleaner burning and longer burning, and I love to promulgate that myth. But you can make a candle burn well, both paraffin and beeswax. But beeswax is more viscous. It's going to give you a larger flame. The flame's going to be a little bit more on the orange side than the bluish side, a little warmer flame. It's going to burn more evenly. It's just a different candle. And the burning characteristics are such. There's also, on a liturgical side, you know, a candle stands as a sign of sacrifice. The symbol is not the candle, it's the flame. And the candle is consumed so that there might be light. So the analogy to Christ giving up himself for the light of the world is a very strong symbol in the Christian community. Furthermore, it's a light divided yet undimmed. We can share a lot of lights from that one candle, but not lose any luminosity. And then in the Catholic symbolism, there's three types of bees in a hive. There's the queen, there's the worker, and there's the drone. The bees that make the wax are the daughters, the virgins. So there's an analogy to Mary giving of the substance for the candle, which is the sacrifice for the light.
Lots of Christian symbolism.
There's layers and layers,
wow,
and layers of symbolism. It's very polyvalent.
So why did the Catholic Church decide, how many years ago, Martin, that it wasn't so important to have beeswax? Because I'm understanding what you're saying.
Yeah, it's unclear, and I don't know if that was an economic reason or it's one of those customs that it's hard to find out. It was a tradition that was somehow relaxed. I don't know all the specifics of it, but we have a long tradition particularly in the Roman Catholic, as well as the Episcopal and some of the Protestant communities, to burn beeswax. And it's really, there's this ancient proclamation from the 4th century called the Exultet. And it has been said by every Paschal candle on the night of the Easter Vigil. And it speaks of the virtues of the bees. And it says, "Accept, O Heavenly Father, the solemn offering, the gift of the bee and your servant's hands. Now we know the preciousness of this wax, which Mother Bee gives us, a light divided yet undimmed to burn for your glory." So there's a direct reference from the 4th century to the virtues of the bees from whose wax this primary symbol for the light of Christ can be had. So when we talk about tradition, it goes back millennia.
I want to ask you about when you had this moment of, I really need to get involved in protecting these bees, educating people about the bees, honoring the bees and their work, kind of became an evangelist for the bees. But just before that, I have to ask you, Martin, it's really dark this week.
It is.
I mean, you know, it's almost the solstice. It gets dark so early. It's dark in the morning. How do you see the role of the candle in your own faith tradition, Martin, but also in people's spiritual lives in general, even people who, you know, don't have any faith-based practice? Even when we have electric light, you know, ready at the flick of a switch, we still sometimes prefer to light candles.
Laura, that's an excellent point. And, you know, I think whether one is religious or not, a theist or an atheist or agnostic, there is a human metaphor that transcends and predates any association we may give with candles. If you think for a minute, when do we light candles? Most people would say birthdays, anniversaries. But it goes beyond that. If we're going to have a romantic dinner with our beloved, it's a candlelight dinner. If there's going to be a peace march, it's usually candlelight at night. And if, God forbid, a tragedy happens on the side of the road, two things pop up immediately, flowers and candles. Think of second for the Olympics. We start the Olympics by taking a flame, traveling it or moving it halfway around the globe at times. So there's this very strong metaphor between lighting a candle and marking a special moment in one's life. Now, once you take that basic metaphor and place on top of it liturgical or religious significance, St. Paul says we should be children of the day, not of night. We should put our candles on the hilltop, not under a bushel basket. Christ, who says, I am the light of the world, the darkness cannot overcome it. Then you get these other layers. It's like an onion, one layer on top of another layer, that these candles then take on special significance. And I think we keep having to go back to the idea of, you know, why are candles so important? It's not just the light and that we're drawn to the light, but there is this element that a light divided yet undimmed. I can take my candle and I can light your candle, Lauren, and I can light a million other candles.
There's a connection there.
But not only a connection, I don't lose any luminosity from my candle by the sharing of its light. So I have just as much light before I shared it as I did after I shared it.
In fact, you create more light.
Correct. And it's the multiplication, the duplicity, the expansiveness of light. And it's not a diminution. It's by the sharing, we increase the light. And that's a powerful symbol, I think, whether one is a theist or not, that we as human beings need to be connected and to help each other.
Well, and anniversaries, birthdays. Earlier this month, the Jewish community celebrated Hanukkah, Festival of Lights. Lots of candles involved.
There is. Light has been a preeminent symbol throughout our human history, and candles figure very significant in that.
I want to remind our listeners, Martin, that they can join us with their questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Martin Marklin. He's founder of Marklin Candle, a liturgical candle producer in Contoocook. He, along with his wife, Christine, provides specialty candles for churches and cathedrals around the country and the world, including for two former popes and the current pope during his visit to New York. Now, Marklin is also past president of the Kearsarge Beekeepers Association, and he's represented New Hampshire at a regional beekeeper conference. And we're going to focus on the connection between bees and beeswax and Marklin's own really large efforts to educate people about the importance of the bees. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Martin, you made liturgical candles for many years. You and Christine started this company. It's really grown, as you said. At what point in your career did you think, I really need to step back and honor the work of these creatures that produce my beeswax? Was it a slow realization or a sudden aha?
It was a little bit of both. I was approaching my 50s, a good time for sort of a midlife crisis. But I had this philosophical compunction. You know, I made beeswax candles. Our company has purchased over $250,000 of beeswax in its history. And I didn't have a clue how the bees made wax. And if someone were to say to me, okay, you make beeswax candles, where do you get the wax? And if I said bees, and they said, well, how do they make it? And if I couldn't answer that question after 30-some years of making candles, I said, this is ridiculous. So a friend of mine, a priest friend from Texas, had a hive, gave me some equipment, and I started this journey some about 10, 11 years ago. And it's probably been the most singular transformative moment in my life in terms of a realization, both how I live, how I operate our business, through the eyes of this creature. You know, you may have 50, 60,000 bees in a hive and get hundreds of pounds of honey. But when it's all said and done, you only get 1 to 2 pounds of wax. Our company buys 30,000 pounds of beeswax a year. Well, how many bees do you need for that? You need 1.5 billion. Not million, billion. Well, how many bees is that? Stack them up, head to stinger. You could go 3/4 way around the world. That's how many bees Marklin Candle needs.
And that's just you.
I'm the smallest of seven, and we seven account for only 15% of the beeswax consumption globally. 85% of beeswax is consumed by the pharmaceutical and health and beauty communities or industries.
Yeah, when you start looking at the labels, you see a lot of beeswax.
Every tablet, every gel cap, every Tylenol, Advil is coated in wax.
So it doesn't upset your stomach or your throat.
Well, it's so that they can slide down. It's the lubricity of the wax. They're usually coated in candelilla and carnauba, but the beeswax is a polishing agent. All hard candy, M&Ms, and Mikes and Ikes, they're all coated in wax.
Wait, Mikes and Ikes and M&Ms are coated in beeswax?
They're coated in wax. All our hard candies, our cosmetics, our food. And what's really interesting, as you come to find out, is the wax, which is the honeycomb in the hive, is the liver of the hive, and it absorbs everything the bees bring back with its pollen and its the nectar. And it's absorbing all the pesticides that the bees are now foraging in. So there is no such thing, and here's the spoiler alert, there is no such thing as pesticide-free wax anymore in the U.S. or practically in the world. There's very few remote places in the world where you can get wax that has not been tainted by pesticide. So when we think for a second, the untold story here is not the wax that we need for candles, although that's vital to my industry. It's how much of this wax we're ingesting through our lotions and our cosmetics and our creams and our food that is tainted with pesticides that we don't know about.
Well, and I never thought about that until I started preparing for the show. And now I'm picturing myself, you know, putting on my face lotion in the morning and, you know, taking vitamins or whatever. And you read beeswax on the label and you think, oh, that sounds healthy.
We do. We have this kind of, you know, it's organic, it's healthy. But a bee will fly up to 5 miles from its hive and return to the very same spot it takes off using the sun as her GPS. However, to guarantee there's no pesticides, we would have to guarantee in that 25 square mile, not one person is going to spray any kind of herbicide, fungicide, pesticide. And that's not going to happen. You know, because bees know no boundaries or territories. You know, they had this whole thing farm to table down before it became hip. I mean, they only ate what's in season.
They only eat local.
They only eat local. They only eat what's in season, what's nearby. You know, so before it became hip, this farm to table and eat local. So they are at the mercy of we who are their stewards. You know, what's interesting is, you know, beekeeping, the word itself suggests a stewardship. You know, many times we'll say, I have a dog, or I have a cat, or I have a horse, or a fish. And we use the word have.
Yeah, so it's ownership.
Correct. But beekeeping is we keep the bees. We don't own them. We're their caretakers, you know. And they predated us in many ways, you know, before we tried to domesticate them. But the whole idea of beekeeping suggests in the very name a relationship of stewardship that is less about ownership, and how can we be a collaborator in their health?
So stewardship for you means what, Martin, in your own farm, in your own production facility?
Well, I think stewardship, again, whether one's any religious perspective, by virtue of our humanity and by virtue of the fact that we as human beings have been given something, creation, regardless of how we feel it got here. Pope Francis come out with an encyclical called Laudato Si, and it's on care for our common home. And he argues that we need to have a conversation because we have a moral imperative by virtue of being human to take care of that which we have been given. And one could say, lest it perish and lest we perish. So for me, stewardship is, can I have a conversion of my heart that leads to a change in my actions to preserve that which I have?
That's a perfect segue to what we'll talk about coming up after a short break, Martin, the connection between bees, the environment, and of course, your work. And we'll start taking your calls, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Hi, it's Rachel Martin for Morning Edition. We're at a point in the year when we set our sights to the future. while reflecting on yet another year gone by.
To rescue 12 boys and their soccer coach from a flooded cave has succeeded.
SpaceX successfully launched what is now the most powerful
photo of the students who all moved here within the last year from countries in Africa, the Middle East, and
support the reporting that keeps you connected all year long with your year-end tax-deductible donation today. Go to nhpr.org and thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a Christmas story about light and nature that starts in New Hampshire and spreads far beyond. We're talking with Martin Marklin, a Contoocook-based specialty candle designer whose products are used in churches and cathedrals around the world. Marklin says becoming a beekeeper transformed his work and deepened his spiritual connection to it. We're finding out more. Also, later in the hour, we are delighted to bring you an excerpt from NHPR's recent event with U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith. That's coming up in about 15 minutes here on The Exchange. You can join us now as we talk about beekeeping, candle making, and the connection to this dark and spiritual time of year. 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, Martin, what did you not appreciate about bees before you became a beekeeper? I'm just wondering what you didn't get about the work that they do.
Well,
probably everything.
I think everything. I mean, there's so many gifts from the bees. I mean, most people think of honey. It's called the honeybee. So that's probably its signature gift that most people associate with. Most people think of stings. But actually, the sting and the venom is actually a benefit. There is such a thing as called apitherapy, namely using the venom of the sting for medicinal purposes.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Arthritis.
Right.
Then there's propolis, which is a tacky substance that the bees get from trees. That they ingest, add some enzymes, and it becomes an antimicrobial characteristic, and it can be used as a tincture. There's royal jelly, which people take. There's pollen. We have all these gifts from the bees, not to mention wax. So I was focused on the wax as a candle maker.
Sure, and why wouldn't you be?
And then my eyes expanded to this plethora of gifts of the bees. Most notably, which is reaching the news today, is pollination. That is the signature thing, and that is the basis for American agriculture. On the wings of the bee, we feed ourselves. Because without the bee, and the reason the honeybee is so important, it's a generalist. Now, we had feral bees before the bees came to the United States in the 1600s, in the 1660s. They came over with the settlers. So the bee, as a generalist, doesn't matter if it's a pumpkin, a blueberry, an almond. She's going to forage and take the nectar and the pollen from that, and in the process, pollinate that crop.
So that's what's great about honeybees, is that they can pollinate
anything. And we can move them around. They're mobile, and they're generalist. And the almond industry, if we want to talk about, is the preeminent focus of the pollination in the United States. California alone accounts for all of the almonds in the United States and 80% of the almonds worldwide. And the almond industry in California requires that they have 2 beehives per every acre of almond if they want to get insurance. Now, in the 1940s, we had 6 million managed beehives in the United States. Today, we have roughly over 2 million. We have a third of the bees today than we did in 1940. On February 15th, we need to send to California 1.8 million bees.
We meaning?
We in the United
collectively,
States.
Collectively, sure.
So roughly 75 to 80% of our managed beehives are going to go on a flatbed truck and go to California to pollinate the almonds. 75 to 80%. And then we take those bees and we move them to Texas to do the squash and the pumpkins. And then we go to Florida and do
the
citrus.
They're like migrant farm workers.
They are. And then we take them up to Maine to do the blueberries and the cranberries in Massachusetts and the apples in Oregon. So we're moving these bees around the country, not for their benefit, but that the American agricultural system, which we've come to know as the P's, you know, profitability, production, proximity, proliferation, perfection, you know. So I really say, and unapologetically, if the honeybee, Apis mellifera, is not native to North America, and she came in 1662. She's an immigrant, and she's no different than the migrants who move at night under the cloak of darkness. We move the bees at night, and by the hands of the migrants and on the wings of the bees, we Americans feed ourselves. So if we have a third of the bees today that we did in 1940, and yet we're required to produce more food to feed more people, how do we do it? And this pollination, this moving trucks, these moving these bees around, I think is unsustainable. Because it's essentially, Laura, as if I were to give you green beans for a month, then I'm going to give you carrots for a month, then I'm going to give you broccoli for a month. They don't get the biodiversity of foraging. Gone are the small farms with hedgerows. Hedgerows were so important because they gave the bees the biodiversity. Now we have these monocultures, as far as the eye can see in the Midwest, of just soybeans and corn. And if a bee can only fly 5 miles, that's all her diet.
That's all she gets.
That's all she gets.
Is there an argument there, Martin, for a lot more local beekeepers like yourself taking care of the local crops so we don't have this, giant migration shuttling these bees from place to place?
There is. There's one of the benefits of the demise of the bee could be the awareness of how important we are to the bee. It's often quoted, a third of the fruits and vegetables we wouldn't have if we didn't have the honeybee.
Which is amazing.
For one thing, we might run around naked. We wouldn't have cotton. There's a lot of things that this little creature adds to our life that it goes unnoticed, not to mention the candles and the creams and the pollination. But I think there's now a resurgence of local beekeeping. In New Hampshire now, we have 10 local clubs, and we have the New Hampshire Beekeepers Association, and we have 10 clubs throughout the state that are just growing. And every spring, we have what's called bee school. Just one thing, if you go to bee school, you don't want to get an A, you want to get a B.
I saw that joke coming.
You saw that. It was coming. But beekeepers are very helpful. The story is, ask 10 beekeepers a question, you get 11 answers.
Let's go to our listeners, see what questions they have. And then I definitely want to ask you a couple questions of my own about the bees and the honeybee in particular. Again, the number for you to join us today in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest today is Martin Marklin, founder of Marklin Candle, a liturgical candle producer in Contoocook. About a decade ago, Martin became a beekeeper. He's past president of the Kearsarge Beekeepers Association. He's represented New Hampshire at a regional beekeeper conference. He had a spiritual awakening about the huge importance of the bees, not only for his work using beeswax for candles, but in agriculture and other products. Again, the number for you to join us with your comments and questions, 1-800-892-6477. And Martin, to our listeners, Steve's calling from Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, and I love the fact that you've talked about, for many religions, this is a festival of lights with candles, not only for Christmas, but for Hanukkah.
Absolutely.
But I recently ran in a 5K entitled Save the Bees at the Nottingham Earth Day. And the theme of our running was that the bees are in danger, and I love the way he talks about these migrant bees going around, but the fact is that the numbers have decreased, and you've given us some of the reasons, but is there also some diseases or something? Because it's at least when I ran my 5K, I was concerned that we were losing the bees, and that's my reason for calling.
Sure. Well, Steve, thank you so much for calling in, and we've done a number of programs on bee collapse. Have you learned about some of the reasons why, Martin, in your role with these beekeeping organizations?
Everybody wants a quick answer.
Sure.
And to answer that question appropriately, it's really the synergistic effect of multiple factors. It's the use of pesticides. It's the lack of foraging. It's climate change. It's the varroa mite, which came in 1987, which has been a huge, and the viruses that the mite transfers. So it's the combination and the synergistic effect of all those that has really caused the demise of keeping bees, such so that we have a third of the bees today than we did in 1940.
Which is, again, jaw-dropping.
What is. And so I think we all want to hang our hat, hang the blame on one contributor. And it really, you can't, I think, justly do that. But what it has done is brought into focus that the bees are in dire need. And if we don't do something, we collectively, we can't expect them to keep on giving to us what they want without helping them.
So when you say lack of foraging, does that mean just more parking lots and fewer sort of grasses and clovers and trees and other places for bees to fly around and get pollen?
Absolutely. Keeping bees is very simple. They need good nutrition all the time. So if we're going to plant flowers, it's helpful for us, at least in our climate, to plant flowers that bloom at different times of the year. Not all spring blooms, not all fall blooms, because the bees don't eat just in spring. They eat all the time. So they're looking for two things: nectar, which is their carbohydrate, and pollen, which is their protein. And they need both to live, the carbohydrates and their pollen. So they need plants to survive on. And if we constantly take our rural areas and turn them into urban areas, and they have less area to forage and less good nutrition, they're not going to do well. So I think it's a combination of making sure that they have enough foraging and enough good, diverse foraging.
So even if you live in an urban area, put a whiskey barrel out front and fill it with some flowers.
Absolutely. Everyone asks, what can I do?
Right.
And even if you're not a beekeeper, we can all plant flowers and we can all somehow help. And even awareness is a big help. I pollinate several orchards in New Hampshire. I bring my bees to those orchards in New Hampshire, in Concord and in Contoocook. And I have to pull them out the day the petals fall, because the growers are going to spray a herbicide for apple scab. Now, I don't blame them, because apple scab is a fungus that affects the scab of the apple. Doesn't hurt the flesh, but no one's going to buy it because of that cosmetic. So what happens is, if they spray, it's going to kill my bees. I have to move the bees out. And when you talked before about stewardship, if we think that any one of our actions doesn't have a consequence, we're fooling ourselves. If he doesn't spray, the grower, he's not going to sell his produce, and he's going to go out of business. So he has to spray, and consequently, I have to move my bees. We are interconnected in this agricultural human condition of one effect having a consequence somewhere else.
So is the point there, for the rest of us who aren't apple growers or beekeepers, go ahead and buy that apple with the little brown spot on it?
How many times do we go to the grocery store and pick the very first fruit we place our hands on? I never do.
We look at them.
We look at them. We move them around.
Sure.
We want the perfect peach, right? A third of the peaches never make it to market, not because they're uncosmetic. They're not sellable. So I guess the question about stewardship and conversion of one's heart, how can we as a society find some other way of not holding this perfection? The sell-by date on food is a big contrary, because it doesn't mean the food is bad. It's maybe just optimal. But if I can't sell it past the sell-by date, look how much food we're throwing away. So I think it raises questions, this whole bee thing, from an evangelical standpoint, and not evangelical from a religious standpoint, but from sharing the good news, which is what evangelical means, is we need to wake up about how our actions and how we feed our people. Is it just? And is it fair? And are we being the best stewards of that which we've been given.
I can see now what you mean when you say learning to be a beekeeper transformed my life.
Absolutely.
It really does open up this whole window.
Absolutely.
Into the way we eat, our ecosystem,
yeah,
the planet.
Yeah, from picking what fruit I put my hand on at the grocery store to how we feed ourselves. And you had a show on Monday about the environment and the sunshine and just an awareness from composting to gardening.
Well, and food waste is a huge portion, it turns out, of contributing to climate change.
Absolutely.
So there's the bee.
Absolutely. And people don't realize that, though, the connection between the cosmetic, the need for apple growers in particular in New Hampshire to spray for cosmetic reasons.
Well, I wonder if grocers need to start like an ugly fruit section for people who don't care.
Absolutely. Or can those fruits be turned into apple cider or
right.
applesauce? Or how can we get very creative and using and being less disposable.
I have a couple more specific questions about the bees, Martin. First of all, how hard is it to get started raising bees? This is more your role as past president of the Kearsarge Beekeepers Association and less your role as a liturgical candle maker. Because we did a show on bee die-off a couple years ago, and there was some concern among professionals that part of the die-off is due to a lot of people getting in to beekeeping with the best of intentions, but didn't really know what they were doing, and so the bees died over the winter.
There is. I mean, and you have good intentions that sometimes fizzle out, and it is challenging to keep bees. It's overwhelming amount the amount of information you need to get all at once. There's equipment. It's not inexpensive. You need hundreds of dollars to buy the boxes and the veils and the gloves and the smokers and all the equipment. And Marianne Fraser, who's an entomologist, retired a friend of mine from Penn State, made the comment is very apt, is that the surge of backyard beekeepers is actually hurting things because the queen breeders who have to make the queens for the packages that these beginners want to get, they're under so much pressure to produce so many queens that they don't have the time to do it well.
Wow.
And, you know, people talk about the bees dying off. The queens used to last 3 to 5 years. Now they last 1 to 2 to 3 years. If you have a queen that can go 3 years, that's doing well. So the genetics of the bees is changing such that they're not as virulent.
Not as robust.
As robust as they used to be.
Because we're pressuring them to produce more because we're worried about bee die-off.
Absolutely. So when you think about it, you can say, well, the bee clubs are booming, and that's a good thing. But the unintended consequence of that is the pressure on the large queen rearers, breeders in the country is so strong that they have to produce this to meet the demand that they may sacrifice, and they may not have the time to do the genetic selection that would be most advantageous to the species and to us as beekeepers.
So as just regular folk, would it be more advisable for us, Martin, to just plant the flowers and support the foraging?
Well, no, I believe we should be activists. I think we should do the little steps that we can do in our own lives, the flowers, awareness, consciousness. But if we do want to join, the bee clubs are very helpful in welcoming and teaching and mentoring. Beekeepers are very good mentors.
So you can do it the right way.
Absolutely.
Martin, it has been really nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure. It's been all mine.
That's Martin Marklin, again, founder of Marklin Candle, a liturgical candle producer in Kentucook. He runs the company along with his wife, Christine. Coming up, an excerpt from our recent event with U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith. She sat down with NHPR's Peter Biello at an award ceremony in Manchester last week, where she was given the Hall Kenyon Prize in American Poetry. That's coming up, so keep it right here.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.